excellent day. An excellent day.
Well, you know what the most frightening thing in the world is? It's fear.
Every you do, don't fall.
Director Andrzej Zulawski has now left this mortal coil, but he left me with three movies that I have an interest in watching. Cheers, buddy. I'm two down so far. The first one was 1971's The Third Part of the Night. It is set in Nazi-occupied Poland, and I found it really complex. Far too complex for me, and it was vast. It was huge. It was a lot for me to gel with. If I ever see it again, maybe things will change, but I'm in no rush to return to it. I can tell you that. The reviews are through the roof. I just didn't get it. The second one is this film, and I love this film to pieces, but again, I don't really get it. And the third one is a film called Zamanka, and I've yet to see that, but the ratings yet again are through the roof. So I read the synopsis. It says that a mummy, and I don't mean like your mum, I mean a mummy, and a crazed woman with lovely boobs, according to the two reviews that I've read. According to those two reviews, that's what it's roughly about. Doesn't really give too much away, does it? But this one, this is the one. I first saw it just really recently in 2021, thanks to the Evolution of Horror podcast. They covered it. And before I go into one of their episodes, I always make sure I've seen or I'm about to watch that film. And when I got around to it, that podcast just blew me away. It's one of the best podcasts I've ever heard. The film itself, it's set in the Cold War. It's a movie that does in fact contain a human-sized octopus creature that may represent God. It may represent the devil. It may just represent a human-sized octopus creature monster thing. Isabel Adjani, she plays Anna, and also the doppelganger of Anna called Helen. Her explanation of faith and chance is just as confusing coming from her as it is for her to accept either faith or chance. Watch the film, you'll know what I mean. It is bloody strange. Sam Neill, he's also in this. He plays a husband and they're going through this messy breakup. And during the beginning, his plight to get her back and his suffering, it rings very true to the way an obsessive person might act. I really believe it. We've all been in a similar situation, depending on what side you're on, of course. And another character of importance is called Henrik. He's a slightly older man having an affair with Anna. And that's your setup. You ready to go? I'm ready. This is Possession.
Oh, Mark. Your wife keeps her own secrets.
Make her talk to me. It'll be the way that she wants.
Tell me.
Well, I think what you want to do to Bob is...
inhuman. So what you're doing must be human.
You can hate me as much as you like, but it's you who wants to know things for me. So please make it possible.
Different from anyone else. We are all the same, but in different
words. Different bodies. Different versions. Like insects.
And here is that letterboxed synopsis. A young woman left her family for an unspecified reason. The husband determines to find out the truth and starts following his wife. At first, he suspects that a man is involved, but gradually he finds out more and more strange behaviours and bizarre incidents that indicate something more than a possessed love affair. Right, this is exciting. We've got a new special guest being added onto the show today. It is the turn of Amber T from Horn Blood Fire Podcast. It's a podcast that I've recently started to devour. I absolutely love it. She is just as obsessed with horror cinema as I am. So I reached out and, you know, thank goodness she said yes, or else this amazing movie would be without a chat. And I ain't having that. So here we are. This is Amber T and myself discussing not possessed, not possessor, but possession. Praise the Lord.
What is it?
Welcome to the show, Amber. How are you doing?
Thank you. I'm doing really well today. Yeah, it's been a pretty nondescript Saturday where I am. Not been up to much. Just been watching a couple of movies and now happy to be chatting with you.
Okay. Horror movies?
Yes, of course.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, always. What did I watch the other day? So I watched Let the Corpses Tan, which is a really good, like, I guess you would call it like a weird Western crime thriller. But when I saw the title, I was like, great, horror film. And then I started it. I was like, oh, this isn't a horror film. And it was still amazing. But like part of me was like, and then I realized like, oh my God, Amber, you really have to actually watch things that aren't horror sometimes. So that was a bit of a, you know, a wake up call.
I always find if I do that, I feel like, oh, I've wasted a film here. There's only so many hours in a day.
Literally. Yes. Oh, my God. Me too. I'm like, well, I can't write about this. No one's interested in this film. I could have been, you know, watching Polaroid number 6, Revenge of the Shitty Camera or something.
Which sounds really good to me.
Oh, it's great.
I discovered you from your podcast. So it's only been a recent thing. It was the House of 1,000 Corpses one that I listened to first. And then, of course, instantly, when you discover a new podcast, you just scroll back. And like I listened to the intro one, and now I'm just picking from them. I've got Hagazooza next. So, yeah.
Oh, nice. That. That's a very bleak one, that one.
It's one of my favourite films, those. And also, not many people chat about it. So it was really good to see it on there.
Right, yeah, I was so happy. My guest for that episode, Not Your Final Girl, like I gave them a bunch of choices and one of them was The Witch. And I thought, okay, they're probably going to choose The Witch, which is fine. I love The Witch. But then they chose Hagazooza and I was like, yes, no one ever wants to talk about this. So yeah, we had a great time talking about a film that doesn't get enough love, in my opinion.
Well, I mean, let's talk about it. So Horn Blood Fire is the podcast and what made you want to do it? And also, like, where does that fit in with your history of horror? Is it something, like you say, quite recent, or has this been brewing for a long time?
Oh, wow. So I've always been into horror, like, you know, most of us are in this community. Ever since I was, you know, little and watching the Disney movies, I was always like rooting for the bad guy or the creepy one. My dad was always into like a lot of weird sci-fi when I was growing up. So things like, I don't know, like Kate and Mass in the Pit. And he had me reading like The Invisible Man and Chucky and like old sci-fi books like that. So I kind of had, you know, I had no choice from a young age. And then starting the podcast and the Instagram. So I started the Horn Blood Fire Instagram in December 2020, I want to say. And remember a very, very specific feeling is that I had been watching movies over the Christmas period because I was off from work, and I was like, oh, I'm going to start taking screenshots and maybe posting them on my personal Instagram. And then I realized my phone was filling up with all these screenshots, and I had started writing notes, and I was like, do you know what? I'm just going to make like a Instagram for like my film reviews, because I had written a few paragraphs about each movie, and I was like, oh, okay, maybe people will like this. And then the followers just started like not flooding in, but like a lot of people seemed interested in what I was saying, and that was really cool to me. I was like, oh wow, maybe I actually can talk about things as like a full-on hobby. So from there it just kind of snowballed into this thing, like I was trying to review and write every day. And then the reviews got longer and longer until I could no longer like keep them in an Instagram comment. And then someone said to me, it was Joel from West Coast Strange, who I did my first podcast guest spot with him. And then he said to me, you should do a podcast because you obviously have so much to say. I don't know if you can tell by the way I speak now, is that I never shut up.
I love it.
Thank you. I have so much to say, and my friends were like, oh my god, Amber, you really need an outlet, because I really don't want to hear about Slaughtered Vomit Dolls again. So yeah, I started the podcast in last October, I think it was. So we had the first episode out, I released on Halloween, and yeah, no looking back from there. Now I'm about 3 episodes out from the end of season 1, and we'll probably take a little break for the summer, and then season 2 will probably come out in Halloween again, hopefully, if people want to come on.
It's one of those things where if you're like me, you're scrolling around because you've either completely finished one podcast, but you just want something more. But then you don't just want there's so many out there that are the same thing. So you're looking for any angle at all, anything right. That's slightly different. And like, as I say, just took a punt because I'd just seen House of a Thousand Corpses. Let's take a punt on this. And it was really nice the way you guys were talking about it.
Thank you.
It was from this different sort of angle that anyone else would, you know, the old, the machismo, like, is Rob Zombie sort of thing. It's like, whenever I go to an American one, honestly, it seems to be that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was just a really nice change for me and for my listening habits. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Nice
so
one.
Thank you. Yeah, I try to I mean, obviously, I've done some of the classics, like Rosemary's Baby, but then I try to mix it up and do films that maybe people might not have heard of, like Hagazusa, like we mentioned, or even more recent, like indie ones. Like the last episode I just released was about Come True, which I haven't seen a lot of people talking about either. And, you know, in the future, maybe I will get to like the Halloweens and the Friday the 13th, etc. But for now, I'm just like, whatever the guests are vibing with, like, I'm like, let's go with whatever fits. And if it happens to be like one that no one's heard of, that's fantastic.
I was really hoping that you would choose the film that you chose for today's chat. Mm-hmm. But I also thought you're not going to choose it, because this is something that I could just tell that you were bang into and you might want to be saving for yourself. So, yeah. So.
I will take any opportunity I can to talk about this film. I absolutely love it. And yeah, when I saw the year that you wanted to talk about, I was like, right. I know what I want to do. I will do it on my own podcast maybe one day, but
definitely. Okay, right. Okay, so let's talk about it. We're talking about Possession. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a film really new to me. I saw it first just a year ago. Just 1 year ago was my very first viewing, and I rewatched it for this, and I still don't know. I still don't know what it's about. Is it about spirituality, marriage, maybe? I sort of hope it is, but then there's things that are like, oh, that's just a part of it. Is it about like the concept of ownership? I quite like taking that from it. Or is it just a monster movie? Like, honestly, I just don't really know where I stand at the end of it. How do you take it? Like, what's it broadly themed? What's it about? And I'll sit back here.
No, like you mentioned, it is. I remember the first time I watched this film, I was like, when I finished watching it, I was like exhausted. I was like, my mind has just gone everywhere in this film. It's about so much, you know. It's about gender roles, it's about gender identity, it's about familial structure, it's about sex, death, religion, mental health, demons. Is it a literal demon? Is it a metaphorical demon? Is it an alien? Like you said, there is just so much about this film. It is all over the place. And I have, in the past, I have had a tendency to read it through kind of more of a gender identity way of looking at it. And also, like you said, ownership of Anna as a character. But yeah, it could just be a movie about a creepy octopus demon. And that's still awesome if it is.
So, well, I love a film like it where you can just take anything at all that you want with it and you can run with it. And because it's so well made and because it's so interesting and you know they've not cut corners, that you can just pick a scene, for instance, and just fall in love with just that scene. Even like I mentioned here, we're going to talk about the look of Possession, but like the way the camera just rarely stands still, it like keeps you constantly involved with what's going on, whether it's a character's walking down the road or whether they're sitting across from each other. I think it's brilliant that way.
Yeah, it's such an erratic movie. Like you said, there's very little like steady cam shots. It feels like, I don't know the exact cameras that were used, but it definitely feels like a lot of it was handheld, and it, you know, has that like shaky following feeling. Like, yeah, it's just the whole film is just like an onslaught on the senses, basically.
There is this particular scene that we'll get to, which everyone talks about. But for me, this... what really got me and what really drew me into the film, where I knew I'm completely in safe hands and I think I love it, was the cafe scene where they're having a chat with each other, but they're on different tables and chairs.
Yeah, just completely so facing close. Away from each other.
Oh, God, I love it. And it makes me love cinema. And this isn't in a horror film from the 80s. I just absolutely find that fascinating.
Yeah.
Also, just the way it is blocked with those cameras that just won't stop moving. I think that's my favourite. Apart from the subway scene, is there something that really pulls you into this film?
I remember the first scene, while I was watching it the first time, the scene that really got to me is when Anna and Mark are fighting in the kitchen when she's chopping up the meat. And, you know, she's got that meat, I don't know what you call it, a meat cutter machine thingy, like an electronic knife.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, when you're watching a horror movie and you see that, you're like, oh shit, that's going in someone or on someone. Like, so from the get-go, I was immediately tense. And, you know, we've got this scene of like her dicing the meat. She's putting the meat through that machine. And the whole time they're just fighting and saying like the cruelest things to each other. And then she just loses it, takes the knife and cuts her neck. And I was like, shit. Oh, my God. Okay, this is a movie right here. It was a lot.
You don't see something like that coming, which is so clever about this thing. It's one of the interesting things that I found about it was the actual casting. I know Sam Neill. I know him from so much, and he was acting pretty Sam Neill-y. When I started watching this, I thought I really felt safe. I knew what was going on, but it's with Anna that things are completely different about this film, and you can't confuse it with any other film. This is a performance, I think, for the ages. Before we go into like what she brings to it, do you think it was the director's intention to actually have this sort of massive feminist type of concept that anyone can just pull from this because it's there? And yet, I don't know if he meant it. I don't know.
Same. I go back and forth on this film so much, and I think I have finally decided that it is a feminist film. And I'm sure a lot of people disagree with me, but because there are scenes in which, you know, Mark hits Anna, you know, very graphically, she gets slapped around by him. And, you know, there's an argument to be said that is representative of the misogyny in the marriage. But it's also, some people might say, well, is it a bit gratuitous? Do we need to see her getting quite so battered?
Right.
There's also the scene with Helen, who in herself, her existence is like a very feminist statement, you know, this like doppelganger as male fantasy. She's like the perfect subservient housewife. But there's this amazing scene where Mark is like, I'm at a war against women, and he starts spouting off this like MRA, like it's just like not all men kind of thing. And she just tells him like, no way, women do not have anything in common except menstruation, which is obviously a very like gender binary way of looking at it. But from the 80s, I think a statement like that is she just doesn't, she doesn't accept it. She's like, no, you need to stop moaning and being a little bitch, basically, because women aren't evil. You're the one who's contaminated. And so, yeah, I think there is a lot in this movie that women can pull from. And that's why I have always gone back to, and I wrote the article about how Anna is so relevant even to women now. And that's what I found when I first like joined the horror community, was just how many women resonated and related to Anna, especially the scene that we will get into in a bit.
I will pop people into the direction of that in the show notes, because yes, it's a fascinating article, and I did not pick up a lot of that from my second watch, you know, so I'm only two watches deep. And it's so weird that, like, I know that I'm going to be watching this again, and I'm going to be really taking new stuff from it, just from like reading an article like that. So yeah, again, nice one. Really, yeah, all right. Enough ass kissing.
No, please, than that. Continue. But...
it's right, we get to this performance then. So it's unreal to me. The first time I watched it, I didn't like her. I was like, why are you in this relationship? This is toxic. I'm just thinking I'm with Sam Neill until I'm not with Sam Neill. But we get to this subway scene. And again, the reason why people, I think, love this scene so much, and whenever you close your eyes and you think of Possession, you're going to be thinking of this scene, is because it's, if it was a short, it would be a perfect short. If it, you know, it's just the perfect moment in this film, and it makes so much sense and no sense. When you were first watching this, I don't know if you can take yourself back, but what was going through your head of what was going on from the moment she leaves that church?
So I came to Possession at a very, very dark time in my life, which I wouldn't recommend to anyone, but I also kind of would, because it was at this phase in my life where I was very much, you know, I was watching films like Blue Velvet and Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, and just these like really dark, violent, sad films. And so I came to Possession, I was like, yes, this makes me feel like shit, and I already feel like shit. So when I saw the subway scene, I felt such a release in me as a woman who was having my own mental health crisis, to see that I had never seen anything like this in film before. You know, sometimes if we see like a mentally ill woman in a film, she'll be like a little, you know, smudge makeup. I had never seen a woman like bleeding, throwing up, screaming. God, the screaming in this scene is just like, it just tears you apart from the inside out. And so the first time I saw it, I think I actually had to like pause after this scene and just go and like have a cup of tea or something, because I was like, oh, do you know what, that might be a bit much. But yeah, I just remember feeling this overwhelming sense of catharsis, but also deep sadness. You know, from the minute she leaves the church, you got that great scene of her looking up at Jesus, and she just got these really sad eyes. And then from there on, it's just like tragic watching this woman lose herself, but also it's liberating. There's, like you said, there's so much going on. It's such a nuanced film. There is no binary in this film, and she even says that later in the film as well. And that's what I love about it. It's like it brings up so many different emotions within you.
There's also a part of that where she starts to dance. It's really a happy moment within this hell that's going on in her. Like, she, it's like she finds whatever is in her that's ugly and evil has been released.
Yeah.
And that's not ugly and evil anymore. That is just so jubilant. And she has to dance. And it's such a beautiful thing. It's like at the end of The Witch, you know, when you know, it's finally, I'm free of this.
Yes.
You know, it's that sort of feeling that I got. And like straight away when I watched it, as soon as I saw that dance, I was just spellbound. Like, what a performance. And and then what happens at the end, when I thought, what was that? Did she just lose a baby? What happened there? I didn't quite get it. Like, what, at the end of this, what do you take from it now after maybe watching this several times?
Well, again, it's this thing like, is it real or is it metaphorical? Because she says, I miscarried in the subway, but she says, I miscarried Sister Faith. So before this, Anna is given this speech about Sister Faith and Sister Chance, which is kind of like there's this YouTube channel called Style is Substance. He did a great video about how this scene is like the battle between your faith and losing your faith and, you know, embracing a darker side of you, which is great and goes into it in way more detail than I ever could. But yeah, it's whether you read it as a literal miscarriage, which she could well be having, because, you know, we see the blood. We also see there's a very metaphorical smashing of eggs and milk against the wall. You know, these are foods that come from women. That sounds really gross and weird to say, but it is. It's like a violent smashing of eggs. So it could be a very real miscarriage of a child, or it could be a metaphorical loss of faith. You know, the film is called Possession. Is this the moment where she gets possessed? I don't know. Every time I go back, I never find an answer. I'm more inclined to think it's a metaphorical one, but who knows? I don't know.
Do you know anything about the actor herself, like Isabel Adjani, I think it is? I can never pronounce that surname, and I wish I could.
I think it's Adjani, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. We'll say it is, definitely. 100%, that's what it is. But do you know if like this was a one-take sort of deal? Because there's several cuts in there. Because I can't imagine like writhing around on the floor. It's so wet and dank in there. It's
disgusting. Yeah, I think they filmed it really early in the Berlin, what they call the Autobahn. And I think if it wasn't one take, it was two. Because I from what I've read, Isabella Gianni could like not do it after with this, and there are rumors, she's never said anything, but there are rumors that she had like a nervous breakdown after this scene, excuse me, which if she did is completely understandable,
right?
But yeah, I think it was one or two takes. I don't think they could have gotten it out of her again, to be honest.
Because I was thinking to myself with this last watch, when you're watching it a little bit more analytically, it's like, how many times can you do this before it becomes a formula? Because what I'm looking at there, it looks raw. And it's so rare that something looks that raw on
the
screen.
It's so feral, yeah. You can tell, like, it's coming from Isabella Gianni's, like, real depths of whatever she was going through at the time. And, yeah, like you said, I don't think you could do this multiple times, because you'd end up repeating the same moves and it would start to look like formulaic, or it would start to look scripted or planned. And I think what they captured is like the perfect feral, roaring, wild woman. And I just love it so much.
Do you know what? I cannot wait until you take this one up and do a real long, deep dive into it. I'm so excited about it. I didn't say that I was going to ask you this, but I'm going to. What do you think of Sexy Squid Monster Man? I mean, what is this about?
You know, the first time I watched it, I was like, this is one of the most interesting and unique representations of a demon that I've ever seen put to screen. You know, usually if you get a demon, you get like the, what's he called? Pazuzu? Yeah. like the horned, you know, creepy little fella. Or you get like just a shadow, or you get something that's, you know, not as specifically different and unique as this tentacled, weird, long-faced creature. And then, yeah, you know, with the ending, and you know, the eyes changing and the creature taking on different forms, I started thinking again, is this even a demon, or is it kind of like an alien? Is this like a Invasion of the Body Snatchers type thing?
And
that combined with like its tentacles and its looks, it makes you think, like, it makes you stop and think, I have never seen a demon represented like this on screen. I mean, from like a physical point of view, I guess it's very phallic. It's got like the tentacles. It's, you know, it's very, it's not sexy, but she thinks it's sexy.
She's not repulsed in any way.
No, she loves it. She loves it. And it's, yeah, it goes back to that whole thing about, you know, women as, can I swear?
Of course you can.
Okay, like women as like monster fuckers, like basically, you know, like The Shape of Water, or like even back in the day, like Dracula, and you know, the whole sexual metaphors behind that. And I think it's partly about like a woman completely letting go of like normal sexual expectations and just, you know, embracing like the grossest, weirdest parts of herself. And that's obviously a tentacle guy that she's into.
The oddest thing about it is it's not done for titillation. Again, this period of the 80s, it's always done for titillation, you know, let's get these men off. It's nothing like that. Like, I left that first watch going, what was that? I thought I was in this other film. What is this? You know, I had no idea what was going on. And second watch, again, no. I think I'm going to have to hit YouTube and just like, what is going on with this thing?
There's so many good analyses of it on YouTube. Yeah, and even myself, I'm not sure where I stand on it. I think it's, like I said, a case of a woman completely losing herself to her disgusting inhibitions, whatever they may be. And then, you know, at the end, he takes on Mark's body, or I say he, but it, whatever it is. Does it take other people's body? Is there more than one of them? Has it bred? You know, it's there's so much there to think about with it. It's so creepy.
Yeah, I don't even know what else to say. But yeah, it's just another scene on top of another scene on top of another scene that is just creating this such a unique film. I don't know. I think this film is something really special for me. And as I say, I'm two watches in. So like, yeah, I've got good times ahead.
You will find when you go back that you will like see things that you like I mentioned before, like the egg smashing thing. That was something I literally only clocked on my viewing this time, and I think I've seen the film, God, must be like going on 10 times now.
Right.
Like every time you go back to it. And also depending on how you are feeling at the time of watching it, you will take on a different interpretation of it. Like for me personally, watching it this time with like the news coming out of America that, you know, like the abortion ban and things like that, I had a very different watch of it and more of a like literal view of childbirth and, you know, monstrous birth and monstrous sex and things like that. So it's just an amazing film to go back with a different cultural context and refresh your whole thinking about it.
It's that thing. Women always just seem to be trapped by men as
yeah, sucks.
Okay, we're going to take possession as a starting point. Two other movies that you would recommend to our listeners that have maybe seen Possession and think, right, where am I going to go now? What would you recommend?
The first one I thought was Jacob's Ladder by Adrian Lynn or Adrian Lyne. I'm not sure how you say his name. But that is another movie that I was watching around the same time as I got into Possession. You know, it's also about this disintegration of a marriage and... I'm not going to spoil it because there is a big twist in that film, but you know, there's the whole question of good, evil, heaven, hell. Is it supernatural? Is it metaphorical? Is any of this actually happening? I also find it's got kind of like a similar bleak feeling to it. Like Possession is such a bleak, concrete, right, brutalist film. Like it's so far removed from anything green or anything natural, and Jacob's Ladder kind of gives me that feeling as well. And what I like about Jacob's Ladder is it looks at it from a male perspective, like, whereas in Possession, obviously we have Mark's perspective and it's very much an analysis of male and female, but Jacob's Ladder is really a look at the male psyche and what holding on to trauma can do for men. So that's the first one I would recommend.
With also, before we go, a pre Home Alone Macaulay Culkin. Come on.
Yes! Oh my gosh, yes! I just.
Perfect.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I just remembered that. Thanks for reminding me.
And what's your next choice?
The second one is Lars von Trier's Antichrist.
Jesus!
What a triple bill I have planned for everyone. Antichrist is another great film if you want to get into the topic of like, is it misogynist, does it hate women, or is it actually secretly very feminist? I still haven't made my mind up, but I don't care because I love it. Another impossibly bleak, horrible movie that is about the disintegration of a marriage, and you know, it also has that really interesting parallel between women and the demonic. And it looks at that trope and it subverts it. So, yeah, I think those two go hand in hand really nice. Well, not nicely, horribly, but you know what I mean?
I could just imagine a night curated by Amber.
Oh, yeah, great fun. Great fun.
Bring all the family.
Yeah.
Before we go, let the listeners know what you've got coming up.
Most exciting thing development recently is that I am going to be featured in Hear Us Scream Volume 2, which is a collection of personal essays from women and non-binary people about our experiences in the horror community and horror in general. and I am so excited to be one of 35 amazing contributors. It's the first volume was really amazing. Like, there are so many fantastic essays in there and give you a real insight into like the similarities that a lot of us hold about horror in our hearts and how we go to it as a place to heal. So yeah, we have currently the Indiegogo campaign, which is still going to be ongoing when we release this podcast. So yeah, if anyone wants to support that, then please do, because that would be amazing. And yeah, check out my podcast, Horn Blood Fire. And I think, yeah, by the time this comes out, we will almost be finished season one. So yeah, and if anyone wants to be on season two, then hit me up, because I'm always looking for people, and Paul, yourself included, of course.
Anytime. Amber, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about Possession.
Hey, thank you so much for having me, Paul. This was so much fun. I could talk about this movie forever. And yeah, I love this discussion.
Once again, a big, even bigger thank you should head the way. All the positive vibes, just head that way to Amber T. Thank you so much for taking part, Amber. Fingers crossed she will return. Right, okay. Just like with John Carpenter, Zalorski not only directed the movie, but also composed the film's electronic score. Where it differs from Carpenter, though, is that this is nowhere near as full-sounding as one of his scores. Although what is quite similar is those early Carpenter scores, yeah, they've got a real cheap keyboard sound, and this one is no different. That cheap keyboard, it takes the lead here. And again, like Carpenter, sorry to keep saying it, it really works well. It creates an oppressive and rigid backdrop to this film. And there are a lot of wonderfully odd inflections. There are some strange flute runs here. There are bean shakers being added, I think, here and there. It all adds colour, I guess. And although I do recognise most of the instrumentation, there is that odd feel about it. And I think mainly it's because I don't know what keyboard is being used here. But it's not just like that. There are more melancholy moments, though, just like on the track Helen Has Green Eyes. This one just has a simple piano run. It's utilized throughout that track, and that melody captures like this sad feel. It just aches under this sad mood that it's creating. All told, I think it's a pretty sweet balance, and it in no way negatively affects what you're watching on the screen. But as a solo listen without those visuals, it's pretty good. And it's really going to either rub you up the wrong way separately, or you're going to love it. And I think it's because of that keyboard that I mentioned. You can date this thing instantly to the late 70s to the early 80s. I personally think that's a great thing, but you might not. I like it. And where can you watch Possession? Well, the only place at all where I could find it where you could stream it for free is something called Metrograph. And that's in the USA. It is available everywhere, but you got to pay a price. Probably cash rather than your soul. As for podcasts, I'm going to mention just one because, as I said before, it's perfect. If you want a deep dive, and I suggest that you do, Mike Munzer's Evolution of Horror podcast, they covered Possession back in August 2020 with Anna Butskaya. It is so good. I can't recommend that enough. You want a film about relationships? You want to be scared shitless? You want to feel really bummed out? Then Possession is the film for you. I'm just going to come out and say it. My favourite horror film from 1981 is the 10 out of 10 lunacy-fuelled The Evil Dead. Director Sam Raimi is a force here, and I think at that very moment he just burst onto the scene with this debut, nowhere near fully formed, but already capable of blowing people's minds. The editing of the drive to the cabin is so clever. The oncoming truck, the bridge, the camera gliding from above and behind, it is very, very accomplished. And when I think of this one, I think of it like he's making cliches work as if they were brand new again. Case in point being the bench stopping, you know, where it bangs on the cabin and when the key's reached for and he grabs the key, it just stops. And also with that clock stopping like that, all been done before, all done incredibly well here. They just rarely executed that proficiently. And I also want to mention here that, and this has to go out to his just keen eye and quick thinking, and that could be seen on this film when he utilised that thick fog outside the cabin. It looks just so classic horror, but it is real. There is such a great shot of their faces looking down into the cellar. I just love that moment. And another thing I want to bring up is that there are a lot of shots on this that are out of focus, but somehow just doesn't matter one bit. When I watched this the last time round, it actually added to the charm of the whole thing. And finally, I just think this movie has heart, mainly down to the lead, Bruce Campbell. He plays Ash. Of course he plays Ash. And what I mean by having heart is when the shit really kicks off, Ash has got that chainsaw out, but he just can't bring himself to kill Linda. It doesn't take long, fair enough. Ash attacks Linda in the woods with a railway sleeper and then beheads her with a shovel. There is blood everywhere. Fine. But it does take until there's like 25 minutes to go for Ash to just finally lose it. It just took him so long to get there. And I feel in the same scenario, of course it could happen, but in that same scenario, I just think I would have lost it in the first 10 minutes. And that's the thing, his feelings for his partner just prevent this complete collapse really early on. I don't know, it's just a little something that I picked up from my recent rewatch. I really loved it. Actually, I lied when I said finally. This is the final thing. I love that there is a Hills Have Eyes poster in the cellar. I love that. Okay, this is a movie that has been discussed elsewhere ad nauseum, and I'm going to give you a really fantastic podcast recommendation when we get to the end of this. It's been talked about so much for good reason. This is The Evil Dead.
I fear that the only way to stop those possessed by the spirits of the book is through the act of bodily dismemberment.
I don't care what happens to her. She's your girlfriend. You take care of her.
Here is your Letterboxd synopsis. The ultimate experience in gruelling terror. When a group of college students find a mysterious book and recording in the old wilderness cabin that they've rented for the weekend, they unwittingly unleash a demonic force from the surrounding forest. Yes, indeed they do. Right, here to discuss The Evil Dead with us today is the podcast regular, the legend, that is Howard Smith. Now, Howard, or H as he is known, and by the way, I read an article back in 1988 in Kerrang! Magazine that name-checked him as H. So, he gets dibs. All right, Steps, he gets dibs. If you're not a UK listener, Steps is maybe just a UK thing. Sorry about that. But they probably meant very little to you, but it means a lot to me. H was the first. So, well, heroin might have been the first, but that's not a person. That is just a dangerous time. Anyway, H is the vocalist for UK thrash band Acid Rain. He hosts several podcasts, of which the heavy metal podcast Talking Bollocks is one of them. And that is bollocks with a Z, not an S, just like the glam metal band Tiger Tales. Z, not S. He also hosts the official Motorhead podcast called The Motorcast, and he is a movie nutbag. I don't know how he does it, but every now and again he gets some spare time, and I think he just uses that to chat with me about horror. I really appreciate it. What a gent. Last time we chatted with him, it was about Green Room on the 2016 Big Hitter episode, and it was great to have him back for this one. So here we are, two distinguished gentlemen talking all about 1981 Splatter Festival. Come on, live, laugh, love. It's the Evil Dead.
Let's get evil, motherfucker!
So, the Evil Dead, 1981. Yeah. Let's have some fun. Mr. Howard. Yes. I was very intrigued that you took milliseconds to get back. Normally it's a little wait, not long, but it's a little wait. But this one was instant. I want the Evil Dead.
Yes.
It means a lot to you. I know this.
How do you know that, Paul?
Well, something to do with maybe your band and your music.
Yes. Maybe so. Maybe the fact that I was part of writing a song called Within the Woods, which is the name of the short film that Sam Raimi made and took around local businesses to basically get the finance together to make The Evil Dead, hence called the song Within the Woods, which is about The Evil Dead. It contains passages of dialogue from The Evil Dead performed by moi, because we didn't want to A, try and get it passed, or B, they say yes and then we have to pay a load of money. So check it out, kids. Put Within the Woods into YouTube. You'll see a video come up. It'd be a fan video, I think, with lots of footage in it that we didn't do and we have got nothing to do with, because it's the kind of thing that we'd have got absolutely, you know, hauled over the coals for. But apparently, when just a member of the public does it, it's absolutely fine. So watch that, because we daren't make one, but someone did, and it's really cool. That's if you like it.
This has got to be a youthful passion, I'm thinking, because there's certain movies that get you at a young age and you cannot shake forevermore. Let us know your history with The Evil Dead.
The Evil Dead, I first saw it on vinyl. I'm that old. Yeah, but I put a record in a Laserdisc player. All that happened was I melted the disc. Took 2 years to see the film. I saw it on video, which is, of course, what I'm referencing. You know, I saw it on video, as a video nasty. And funnily enough, first time I saw it, it did not have the tree, the affectionately named tree humping scene. Okay. That was too much, even for somebody who was bootlegging a video nasty. It's like, this video nasty is not nasty enough. It's the nastiness has been cut out. This is rubbish. So yeah, when I first saw it, it didn't have that scene in it. And it was like, because that was like a test of, not a test of your masculinity, but it was a test of your, how well connected you were. So, you know, it would go around school. Have you seen Evil Dead? Yeah, yeah. Have you seen, did it have the tree humping scene? No. Oh, well, you know, do you know what I mean? It was like it was one of those moments where it's like you ask for a set of trainers and you get the trainers, but you get the market version. You know, or well, the person in the shop said these are just as good. Yeah, they were fucking selling them. So that it was that kind of feeling, and it took a while of begging a friend, and I got his version, and I didn't know where the scene appeared to watch the whole film again, and that was the only scene that had been cut out of the version I'd seen. But yeah, I remember it being on the news. The Evil Dead was kind of like, it was almost like the straw that broke the camel's back. You know, I remember that. I remember maybe Maniac Cop, that might have been around at the same time. That was getting shit because, you know, oh, it's just policemen. That's terrible.
Yeah, it is. You know?
The police are lovely. They don't commit crime. They prevent it.
Correct.
So, yeah, there was that. And there was something else around at the time as well where it was like, and they were basically saying this is just, you know, this kind of stuff is unacceptable. It's going to damage the fabric of society. It's going to damage our morality. And really, as always, with art of any kind, people who are scared of it give it way more relevance and power than it has. You know, it's you know, a band never started a revolution, a movie never started a movement. You know, it doesn't work like that. The ideas and the passions exist anyway. They exist existentially, and people, you know, get drawn towards particular types of art. That's all. So you know, these people would have find ways of banding together anyway. Yeah, it was you know, it was deemed completely horrific and bad for Britain.
It is still surprising today how far this film goes. Like,
Mr. Puggles is just weighing in, and as usual, agreeing with you. which you know, come on, let's have some neutral opinions here.
Guy. Yeah, I
please don't edit that bit out. Please don't.
I hate that guy. I left him for 10 minutes and he's like kicking up his stink already.
Yeah.
Right. Anyway, stupid, lovely dog. Hey, this freaked me out, right? Rewatching The Evil Dead took me back to when I first watched it as a kid, because I was watching it analytically for the first time ever for this conversation. Yeah. And I remember having seen Evil Dead 2 first and just putting this on and just thinking, well, this is rubbish. Ah, this is past the scene.
Right. No, hang on a second. Let's just like back the truck up. Hopefully I am doing the job of the listener here, or the job that the listener would like me to do, which is people of my era will be going, right. So, you know, that's like I said, well, I saw Empire Strikes Back. And I enjoyed that. And then I went back to watch Star Wars, and that was really boring and slow. And it's like, well, hello. What? Yeah, two comes after one and not before it.
I was 13. So, like,
well, fair enough. It's
allowed, surely.
Well, of course it's allowed. And but all I'm saying is that you've sped the conversation up quite a bit, because once we get to the end of Evil Dead, there's then Evil Dead 2, which is a completely different movie and takes the franchise in a completely different direction.
But I didn't see that though at that age. At that age, I just saw this as, oh, this is where they got those ideas from. They right. didn't execute it as well. I've you got thought Evil was, Dead 2. I'm sticking with
you
that.
You thought it was a demo for Evil Dead 2?
Yes, exactly yeah. that. So, rewatching it, I had it at 9 out of 10. I mean, I've watched this hundreds of times probably since then, but I had it at 9 out of 10. Rewatching it with my analytical eye, I upped it to 10. I can't fault this movie.
Wow.
Anyway, like, I cannot. Wow. I will not. I refuse to. Yeah. What people would pick holes in it about, I would say no. That's what makes this great. Like, I got a proper hard on for this movie, watching it again. Analytically thinking, oh, I'm going to talk about this.
Yeah.
I was super excited about it. It holds up so incredibly well.
It's, I mean, the Blu-ray is crystal clear. some of it is like, the definition is like stunning. And what I really notice every time, by the way, gets me every time, is the simple yet so effective use of the camera close to the ground.
Right.
And the right, you know, the right soundtrack, the right atmospherics going on, and that camera close to the ground is, you know, I know it's not the first movie to ever do that, but it really plays on it. It really plays on it to the extent where it becomes a feature of the movie. And still to this day, like I say, every time I watch it, I just think that is such a brilliant effect. And they could have overused it and they could have underused it. And I think they just get it 10 out of 10. You know, I think they get it just right.
Sam Raimi has, I don't know how he did this. It's, you know, when you go to make your first album and all those ideas come out, and it often can be the very best thing that you ever do because you've had all that time to do that. I wonder if that's the experience with Sam here, the way he created this film, because I also give part two a 10 out of 10 as well. But it's, as you say, it is a different film. Just the way he filmed it, the clever things that he does, the Dutch angles, like for me, what sold it, and I was just like, shaking my head, like, how do you do this straight off the bat when the camera's going over the top of the beams and it's just going, it's so ingenious that he would do that on a budget of £40.
I love the way as well that it's he leans into the cliches. I mean, it's a cabin in the woods. They've got to go over a rickety bridge, and they go over a rickety bridge, and you're just like, well, that's not going to be there afterwards. I mean, that's someone's dying on that, or that's not going to be there. The bridge is a problem. It's like when the character is introduced in a movie. If they cough heavily within the first couple of minutes, that guy's not making it to the end of the movie. It's right there. And it is. So they go across that bridge and you're just like, oh, right, okay. Bridge is knackered. And it just leans into the cliches. Although, again, I'm looking at it now and saying cliches. Maybe they weren't cliches, you know, way back then. But I think they were. It is the archetypal cabin in the woods movie. So much comes from The Evil Dead. It is like, it's not the Metallica of the horror world. It's the Slayer of the horror world. Because, like, you know, the first album's completely different to all the others. But it's kind of like, you know, it gave us Sam Raimi, for God's sake. I mean, you know, it gave us Bruce Campbell. And some extras who play many roles. It's done little for anyone's career other than those people. It's not often you're watching something and you see somebody who's been in an Evil Dead movie. If it's not Bruce Campbell, it's like, it's going to be a bloody long, many, many movies before you go, oh, hang on a second.
I was speaking to my mate Alex, and he said that, well, actually, there is a couple of shitty things in this. And I was like, what? And he said the love story with Bruce Campbell and Linda. And I'm like, okay. So I rewatched that. And I'm like, no, it's quite sweet.
Yes.
Like, it's a sweet
thing. It's of its time. You know, it's set in the early 80s, for fuck's sake. You know, so it's of its time. It's sweet. Yeah.
I like it. You've got the setup with the necklace. I'm not willing to say that that's not well done. I mean, it's slight, but we're in a brutal horror film here. It's not a romance. It's not a drama, you know. So yeah. I'm definitely giving that a pass.
Also, I think that the thing is as well is what it increases the jeopardy, because you know, as you know, you get into the mind of a movie writer and that's there for a reason, because ultimately Ash is going to have to chop her head off, and if it's just next door neighbor's daughter who he went to school with, it's like, oh well, sorry about this. you know, they it's just increasing jeopardies, you know, increase the emotional engagement of the viewer and the characters and everything else. So, I mean, I think it's totally valid and I think it's well done. And I think it makes a fucking arsehole.
Yeah. Yeah.
hopefully he's not listening to this. And if you are, I was only joking.
No, you're right. You're right. He is. Right. hey, tree rape.
Hey,
let's talk about it.
Never done it, mate. Never done it. No, the trees round here are safe.
I was not prepared as a young'un for it, but it didn't.
As you know, I was. That's all I was there for.
I had playground talk afterwards. I'm like, what tree rape? What are you talking about? No, I when I first saw that, I just thought, you know, it's just this other thing. It's horrible, but you know, it's a horror. Looking back now, like with all my years' experience and knowing what is a done thing on film and what shouldn't be a done thing, I mean, this is up there with the things like a Serbian film and things like that. This is horrible from the get-go. And I know Sam Raimi sort of regrets the intensity level that was on film and that he captured. But technically, it's incredible. What we're watching is so masterfully done. I know it's horrible. And sometimes, you know, I want my art to be horrible. I want it to generate conversation. And this does, like, it's something that I will never, ever forget. So, you know, I think it has done its job there. Like, sometimes you've got to be confrontational to make these things work. And it is that. Do you think it goes too far? Is it a funny thing to talk about with two like grown men talking about, well, is this rape? Is it a bit much? But is this rape a bit much, Howard?
Well, yeah. Is it? I don't think so. It's never been repeated. You know, no one else has gone, oh, you know, I'll one up that scene. And no one's even done a tribute to it. And it's been done now and we can move on. That's kind of like how it feels, where its place kind of lives in cinematic society. But yeah, if you go and watch it and you see it for the first time, I first saw it as a child, as you know, and I was obviously, you know, keen to see where's this scene I haven't seen. And when I did see it, because I knew what the scene was, I'd imagined something in my head. So then when I saw it, it wasn't what I'd imagined in my head. There was that to get past. And I think, again, because I was fairly young, everyone was talking about it because it was more a sort of like, oh, did you see that scene? Oh, fucking hell, yeah, it's brilliant, it's hilarious. So when I watched it as a kid, I think my reaction was one of sort of like, oh, that's not what I was expecting. It's like, ha ha ha, you know, it's actually quite funny. And years later, you know, you look back at it now, watch it now and go like, ah, right, okay, yeah, fucking hell, that's, funnily enough, not funny.
Right.
So yeah, it's there. I guess I think there's so much that is better about the film than that. Do you know what I mean? It's like talking about a Bond movie and focusing on the gadgets. It's like, well, no, that was just a tiny part of it. There's so much more. But rightly, you know, hugely controversial. But as you've pointed out, really, really well done. Possibly, as Sam Raimi is hinting at, a bit too well done.
That's the thing. It's difficult to comment from today's point of view, because I think a director would think twice about doing it.
Oh, God, yes.
I would be very unsure whether, you know, because that could mean your film doesn't get a distributor now, you know, and I can see why it was lumped in with the video nasties of the video nasties. I remember watching Cannibal Holocaust and the actual animal slaughter that was real. And I was looking like with my hand to the screen because I just didn't want to watch that. And this wasn't like that, because I knew this was pretend. So, you know, for me, things do go further and they shouldn't be there, but they are. And I still love that film. So, yeah, it's tricky. I'm not clever enough, I don't think, to sort of put my thoughts into a linear fashion like yourself.
It's a hard thing to discuss. It really is. You know, as a lover of women and trees, I don't wish, you know, I don't wish any of them ill. I'd just like to point that out there in case I've said something that's worth cancelling me for.
Those tree huggers will be after you, sunshine.
I know. It's terrible, isn't it? Terrible.
Right. Okay. So the issue with this film is that everyone has seen it. Everyone has a thought on it. It's a huge, huge film in horror. Like there is no one that loves horror that hasn't seen this. But have we missed something out with the general discussion that you'd just like to say about it? Maybe how something made you feel, maybe a favourite scene or something like that, before we talk about these sequels in brief.
There is humour in the first one. There is humour in the first one. It's just, it becomes overt later on, as we'll discuss. I guess really, for me, it's what kind of lives with me is Dead by Dawn, is just that, you know, the concept of having, you know, a loved one trapped in a basement, still alive, turning into something that is God knows what. But that whole Dead by Dawn is just, that's next level. I remember as a kid just being like, oh, you know, nasty. And that's why I made a thing out of it, you know, in the song as well.
Well, I'm happy you did.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Absolute pleasure.
For me, like the bit that I picked up in my most recent watch was everything quietens down for a second, but there is peril everywhere. Linda is possessed, sitting down only a few feet from Ash, and she's cackling with laughter. And that's the quiet you get. That is the like brief respite in this mad as hell film. That is terrifying. I loved that scene. It really got to me with her eyes with those mad contact lenses, which must have been so painful. So that's what I left this film with in my head. It's just like, wow. Let's talk about the sequels. So,
yes.
I, as I said, began with Evil Dead 2. As a kid, I didn't rate the third one much. I really loved the remake. I went to see that at the cinema, and now I love them all. Maybe 3 gets an 8 out of 10, which I still think is pretty high. But no one cares about what I think. What do you think of these sequels?
I think 2 is great. It's great. You know, it's literally Sam Raimi going, hey, why don't I make the first one again, but as a comedy? You know, and you know, it'll live with me forever. You know, his hand is giving him the finger. It's just like,
how can it not?
It's just genius. It's just comedic genius. And there's all the lines are in the second movie, you know, groovy, and you know, the chainsaw and all the rest of it. So it's it's great. I mean, I love it. And then I remember waiting to go to the cinema to see Army of Darkness. I was living in Newcastle. I was in a band. We were all living together. Us and other bands, we all in the same movies. We all went down, watched Army of Darkness. And we got what I think is the best ending of Army of Darkness as well, which is he's back at the mall. He's back working in the mall.
What's this?
The cinema ending in the UK is... Right. It is he gets his drops wrong, and when he comes round, next scene, he's back working in the mall.
I've never seen that.
And they're all having a chat, and then someone would say there's a noise or something, and then all of a sudden, like, you know, a flying demon appears or something like that, and he just turns to this woman and says, get me an axe. And it's
I am on YouTube after this conversation. Oh,
The best ending, definitely. I think it's on one of the Blu-rays. I think it's on the extras. I think, or you can select alternate ending. And I think it's
nothing of it.
I think that's a much better ending than the massively cliche ending that's on, you know, the version that most people know. In fact, the one you know. And I love the third film. Again, it's eminently quotable. You know, it's just, this is my boomstick. And then, listen up, you primitive screwheads. You know, and it's just, they're all in there. Oh, hello, Mr. Fancy Pants. The little ashes that break out of the mirror, there's an extended version of that which makes the movie drag a bit for me. I think if you watch the completely uncut version with all the little extended bits in, it becomes a bit baggy. Whereas the way it was cut for cinema, except with the cinema ending, I think it's just about right. And like I said, just, and I think there's some really good characters in it as well. You know, and also it's iconic, that kind of falling, the car falling, and you know, and him falling with one hand being a chainsaw. That's just like iconic images. So also the Army of the Dead, you know, having watched Jason and the Argonauts God knows how many times, when you see that in the new Evil Dead movie in the cinema, and you're just going, my life is complete. This is fucking awesome. So
it is fucking awesome. I love that scene.
It is. I've got a lot of love for three. I really, really have. I've got a lot of love for it, to the extent where, if I'm honest, of all the four movies, including the remake of the first one, if I'm going to sit down and pick one to watch, it's probably three, which is
right.
Kind of weird, really. But also, I didn't like the remake of Evil Dead. It's just not. It's a Cabin in the Woods film. Whatever. It just didn't do it for me.
Did you like at least the reference of Rain in Blood, where it's raining blood, literally? I like that. I thought of Slayer instantly.
Do you know what? I don't even remember that. I saw it once at the cinema. You know, and the weird thing is as well, I came in, I was on a date, and we arrived early. We came in as the credits were rolling. So we had to sit there until the film started again. But seeing the credits go up, I was like, oh, this looks really fucking cool. You know, this is like decent, you know, oh yeah, great. Like,
yes.
Yeah. And then I watched the movie and I was like, oh, best bits of credits. Bummer. At least I've got to see them twice. But it just didn't work for me. The licking the knife thing, that was like horrible and brilliant, but it's the only thing that sticks in my mind.
What are your hopes for the new one that is all finished, coming out soon enough? Do you think it's going to be another one to put with the remake for you, or do you think it's going to have some of that lineage? I know next to nothing about it. I've tried to keep myself away from all the adverts and all that advertising, but all I've seen is the poster, and I'm pretty much on the fence at the moment.
My hopes are that it picks up from three and does something interesting. Kind of hope it leaves the door open for more. I think it's an underused franchise. To say that we're getting our fourth now, given when the first one came out in the 80s. I mean, you know, Scream didn't appear until the 90s. And that's, you know, we just got a requel. I know. It's just fucking bollocks, isn't it? We just got a shit film to reboot the original trilogy. It's like, what the fuck? They're on to six movies. And that started in the mid-90s. So yeah, I think Evil Dead's really, really is an underused franchise. But the benefit of that is then when there is a new one, it's special. I hope we get it's not another God knows how many years until the next Evil Dead. I mean,
well, maybe we should be reuniting as such and see what our thoughts are at the time. I know you'll cover it on your podcast with the movie bollocks.
Yes, I will have my movie bollocks out for that. New episode coming Monday, folks, depending on when you're listening to this, obviously. You know, it could already be out. In fact, it will already be out.
Howard, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
That's an absolute pleasure. It always is, Paul. And I look forward to doing the Nicolas Cage special that you've got planned. Hopefully you can't edit that out. I would give people a little Easter egg at the end there, eh?
Composer Joseph LaDuca, he began his career on this mad movie. The issue I've got with this is that it is really hard to listen to this score without the context of where it came from, because each scene of The Evil Dead is so ingrained into my noggin that this score just simply evokes each scene that plays over it. I think you know what I mean by that. It's just that it's just always there. Every time I hear any of this score, I can close my eyes, I can watch the actual film play out in my head. But what is so clever in retrospect, listening to this score today, is it is romantic. It is the romance of it all during all those quieter moments. And fair enough, when this thing ramps up, there's fantastic string plucks and screeches, especially during a track like Rape of the Vines, for instance. But what will take people aback is just how melancholy this thing gets at points. It's proper emo. So yeah, it doesn't always go for that horror fright, but when it does, this is classical terror at its best. On the track called Not the Shower Curtain, the slow build-up of deeper strings is actually quite the listen with your headphones on. Really, really encompasses evil. Just the nastiness, just the horribleness of what's going on. And it's quickly followed by this padded cymbal build-up. And then a piano motif that's just not used again in the whole score. It doesn't need to be that complex, but, you know, why the hell not? This thing is a complete banger. And just with a final thought about this score, I'm going to be watching that movie Triangle soon. I saw it before when it first came out, and I know I loved it, but I can't remember it at all. And I know that LaDuca scores that, so I'm looking forward to the music as much as I am those visuals. This one gets a 5-star recommendation from me. A perfect score. And just to explain that joke, a score is also sort of the musical body that backs up the film. That's a score, but it's also the amount of points you give it out of a certain number. That's a score. Where can you find this? In the UK, you can stream this one for free on Sky Go, Virgin TV, or Now Cinema. What the fuckity fuck fuck is Now Cinema? Please email me in. Also, if you live in the USA, try AMC Plus, Tubi, Max Go, Shudder, or Pluto. As for podcasts, Cinematicon, Ex Mortis. That podcast, they covered this one in January 2021. And here we go. This is what I was talking about earlier. If you want the most in-depth, the best coverage on a podcast of this movie that I have ever heard, well, in March 2022, very recently, Halloweenies covered The Evil Dead in a massive 4-hour two-part episode. It is an absolute nerdy fun time. I cannot recommend that one enough. And that's it. The best that 1981 can get. It isn't Gillette. It's The Evil Dead. Right, let's choose what year we're going to be battling with next month. Oh, by the way, I've now put this in a plastic binder type folder. Every month seems to be a different way of me getting the numbers out. So, yeah, here we go. Just going in here. Going to give it a shuffle. Drop it all over the place. Going to give it a shuffle. Pull one out. Ooh. 1985. Ghoulies. Back to the Future, of course. Back to the Future. Demons. That's what is springing to my mind right now. Day of the Dead. I think that was 85. It's going to be another cool one, isn't it? It's 80s. Of course it is. 1985. All right, there we go. Ghoulies, Demons, what else to say? Back to the Future. It's going to be good. Right, okay. Feel free to contact the podcast at ayearinhorror@gmail.com with any films that you think I missed, or simply if you want to have a go at me. You can follow me at WallerNotWeller on Letterboxd and Instagram, or you can hit me up on NotWellerPod on Twitter. Also on Letterboxd, I have listed all the years that we've tackled so far, attached the films to the proper positions, all that sort of stuff. But you Patreons out there, you're going to have some friends here. You're going to have some new friends. I feel it. Some new people we're going to join. Patreon.com/ayearinhorror. There is a £3 tier. There is a £4 tier. Any contribution that you make to A Year in Horror is going to be put back into making this regular, original and specialist content. But you know that as well as this, you're going to have a warm, maybe fuzzy. It's going to be warm and fuzzy. You're going to have a glow. You're going to have a warm and fuzzy glow about yourself for helping us out here on the podcast. So once again, yes, patreon.com, A Year in Horror. Before we go, a great big thanks to my wife, Claire Waller, who will continue to do all the Photoshop posters for each episode and also the Sci-Fi Corner jingle and the Spooky jingle. One Trick Pony designed the Ace logo and that calendar design for the thumbnails. Max Newton and Lucy Foster, they have now split up. Terrible, that is. Terrible news. Breaking it here. They did their A Year in Horror theme music and the guests. Amber T, the special guest, thank you. Amber Tyrannosaurus, Becky Dark, Perrin Hayish, John Tantillon, Benjamin Bowles, Mark Canale, Paul Chanter, and the late, the great Howard Smith. Except he's not dead, he's still alive, he's not late, he's probably great. Most of all, I want to say a massive thank you to you lot. You've listened to this thing right to the very end. I'll see you all next month for a podcast that will feature the best horror from 1985. That's what it was. Until then, bye.
Excellent.
You know what the most frightening thing in the world is? It's fear.
Every you do, don't fall.